Please join me in welcoming Brent W. from Dana Point, who's our main speaker.
Hey everybody, my name is Brent Walton. I am an alcoholic. I'd like to thank the group for inviting me, thank Lee for asking me to come on up, and you all fed me. That was great. Like, thank you for dinner, right? And at dinner, I was talking to Lee, and it turns out I'm one of these guys. I'll tell you my sobriety date, because you probably want to know, February 12th, 2013. But thank you. I'm one of these guys that in early sobriety, I had nothing going on, and you'll hear about it. I'm crazy. I'm like a mental patient. I am a mental patient I've seen the insides of institutions. None of your jails or prisons. They just, 5150 me, or I 5150 me, and it turns into a 52. And then eventually they give me something, those narcotics, and I think of it as a spa, and then they let me out. This is like a story of my life. But we were talking, and I'm still crazy in early sobriety, and I burned the CDs. I was listening to speakers and speakers and speakers and speakers, and I was just listening to, and Lee's mentioning them. Like, all the ones I kept burning through, repeat, repeat, repeat. And one of these guys, I got to hear him speak in my first year of sobriety, and he said something, and I'll share it with you, because it still sticks with me to today. He's probably spoken here. I think you mentioned he did. Bob Darrell came here and spoke. And he shares this story of when he's going in and there's these crusty old timers, like Lee, right? Like, he's coming on in and he's just looking worn out and gnarly and not wanting to be here. How can you tell, right? Like, how can you tell a newcomer doesn't want to be here, right? We don't. And then he walks up to him and he goes, "I'll promise you an instant miracle. I will promise you an instant miracle." And the way Bob tells it, he says, "Okay, I'll bite. What is it? I promise you, if you turn your will and your life over to the chair, a miracle will occur." And Bob goes, "Okay, I turn my will and my life over to that chair." And the old timer goes, "Congratulations, your life is no longer in the hands of an idiot." That's us. Like, no joke. We have this disease that we're told centers in our mind. For real, centers in my mind, and I am the idiot that listens to it. I'm that idiot over and over and over again. And I hate to break it to you, so are you. You keep listening to you. No matter the series of consequences and events, no matter how bad it gets, no matter how horrible your life is, including the annihilation of everything worthwhile and your existence, you'll listen to you. That's crazy. You too need to come with me and let's go to the institution. Like, this is crazy. And you're presented with an alternative. If you're fortunate enough to come in these doors. And many of us go, "Nah, my head's good." And walk right out. I hope you discover the same thing I've discovered on this journey. That we move from that place of listening to our own minds. That we'll just call it, for sake of simplicity, I'm going to call it self-reliance. We're going to move from self-reliance to this thing called God-reliance. Hopefully you make this transition from self-reliance to God-reliance, and suddenly you are taking directions from the director who happens to move planets and stars. I hope you tap into the source that's in fact here with you and with me. It's animating each and every one of you, and it's just as it's animating me. It's breathing you. It's breathing me. It's beating my heart. It's beating your heart. And it's allowing all of our cells to cooperate so that we can sit and be with one another. When two of us are gathered, God is really there. And the only thing that gets in your way and gets in my way over and over and over again is my mind. And once again, I'm the idiot that listens. I know, it's sweet, it's seductive, it's your idea. And you love the idea of taking credit or assigning blame because it can't be your responsibility for all of the horrendous events and activities and circumstances of your life that you want to blame and assign blame to God, the universe. It's not fair. Your parents, you, your girlfriend, your boyfriend, whatever. It's their fault. Because if I ever get honest with the ideas that are coming in my head, I can no longer justify my behavior and I just want a drink. Simple dynamic going on over and over and over again. But it's the obsession with our ideas that drive us back to the drink. It's the obsession with your own thinking that will drive you eventually back to the drink. Because if you're all you're thinking about, if you are the subject of your thoughts, here's what it looks like. This is a tornado, okay? Like, this is what it looks like. This is physics. And in this tiny swirl is a gravitational pull that eventually is going to require you to get relief from you. And you have one go-to. Right? The thing that quiets the mind. A chemical muffler. Or the radio dial just gets turned down a little bit, suddenly that you're okay in the present moment. Or so it seems to each one of us. So it seems. Remember what we suffer from. It's right in the title of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, right? It's right up front, right at the beginning. We suffer from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. It seems to you and it seems to me. The key part is you're seemingly hopeless. You think it. And I think I'm seemingly hopeless. And it turns out we're not. But in that state where you're listening to your mind and no idea, no God idea, no spiritual idea, no other centered idea can pierce in, it will remain bleak. We will be exhausted. Burning up energy foolishly, trying to arrange life, well, to suit me. Alcoholism, at its finest. Stone cold sober. I want to welcome all the newcomers, right? Like, I'm glad you're here, really. I didn't want to come into Alcoholics Anonymous. It took me a long time. I am 57 years old, and I did not sit down in the rooms with you for real until the age of 44. That's a long time to be self-will run riot. And obstinate and stubborn and driven. That's a long time. I was tired. Usually I just end up going to hospitals. It's a vacation. I'm a lawyer by training, and I still, in sobriety, wanted to think of a way to go ahead and get my 30-day treatment program now. Like, I want a spa vacation. And I was thinking, I'm an alcoholic. I suffer from a disease. It's recognized. It seems like it should be covered on insurance, and I should be able to get it today. Anytime I want. Turns out I can't. And that was a real bummer. Because I still will occasionally think that the hospitals sound like relief. I may as well tell you how I got here, because that's what I'm here to do. I'm here to share with you what I was like. I know you'll hear people say what it was like. The it hasn't changed much. The universe is still the universe, and it moves slowly, it evolves slowly. What I was like, what happened to me, and I'll use the term what happened. You'll hear me say something happened, because I think it's the most common word for God. Something happened. Something actually happened in my life to give my brain, my mind, a shift in perception, a full wholesale change in ideas, emotions, and attitudes. And it's not my doing. I can't possibly change my mind, right? We change it when we deliberate, when we think. We change our mind all the time. But I can't change those fundamental core beliefs that are down, hidden below me at the level of subconscious that I don't even know are driving me back to the drink each and every time. There's no way. I just listen to them and I remain the idiot, right? Like, this is a constant. Something happened. And then I hope to share with you a little bit of, like, what it's like today. And maybe, just maybe, that'll be useful, and I'll be used. And my prayer every day is, God, use me. So, I was born in Provo, Utah. I come from Mormonism. We don't drink no matter what. What am I doing here? Like, I come from real deep stock of Mormonism. One side of the family came over with Brigham Young and settled Salt Lake City. The other side found this the hole in the rock and settled the southern end, were the original pioneers, and Moab, Blanding, and Bluff. There was, my family was the constant mayor of Blanding. You know, it's like just there. This is us. We don't drink no matter what. I can look back through my family lineage. There's none of this. None of this. What is going on? But you know what happens to us? Something happens in life where suddenly I get scared. I feel afraid. I can't live through this pain, right? And it's usually something to for sure will be cemented about the age of 5 or 6, okay? This is just anecdotal evidence, 5 or 6. But if you want to test this theory out that I'm sharing with you tonight, you go watch Kindergartners. You talk about living in the present moment. They're doing it naturally, without fail. They have no other director. They are attuned to life. And in We Agnostics, it tells us to, we're trying to hear to recapture the attitude of a child. Curiosity on wonderment. This is all of us across the globe, and I've traveled the world. All of us are this way up until the first resentment cements in and solidifies. And at that point, there's a fork in the road, and I need to manage life. I need to become the manager because it's not safe. I'm not safe. You're not right. It's not safe. This is just what happens. What happens for other people, like my brother, is they grow out of it. They mature. We stay emotionally stilted and idiotic. Congratulations again. Like, this is our path. We're going to stay emotionally stilted, unable to grow, because we think we need to protect ourselves. Guard against your mind-made sense of self, the image you're trying to protect, the fear that's real or not at home, like all of this. And I'm just going to share with you, here's what happened to me, and my childhood was horrible. Horrible. God took my dad at 6. Natural causes. That man never drank, never did anything. Natural causes. Only it was not natural. Like, everybody at school and around me, they're all pitying me and they're sad for me and I'm sad. My whole world has changed. My brother's world has changed. But here's the deep, dark secret that I couldn't tell anybody. My dad died because of a disease born of incest. There are sister wives in my family. I can't share that with anyone. It's not even cool to share it in Utah. Hey, there ain't nothing cool about that. My mom next brings another man into our lives, and he's a prisoner of war vet. And he's a prisoner of war vet, and he likes to play prisoner of war with 2 boys. And he puts cigarettes out, and he tortures us. And my mom, fearing for her life on how to raise 2 boys, is absent. She's absent. She's going to go develop a really beautiful, high-paying career. And when my dad died, I lost my mother, essentially, to be turned over and played prisoner of war with. Shortly after that, gunfire erupts in the house. He's arrested. It then just turns into stalking us all the time. Meanwhile, the babysitter my mom has assigned to us is a nice lady in the ward who likes to rape boys. The next man that comes into my mother's life is an alcoholic. I love him. Oh my God. Like, I love this man. Ralph was great. The unfortunate part of having a child having a relationship with an alcoholic in alcoholism is he's a 4-day blackout alcoholic. And he does the Thorazine shuffle in his underwear and doesn't remember having a relationship with you. No memory. Ralph does the thing that alcoholics do. He's smoking, he blacks out, the cigarette catches fire, burns the house down, Ralph dies. I haven't had a drink yet. I need a drink. I need a drink. I have a psychiatrist. He's a great friend of mine. Like, I am being, therapy is on. I was being raised in Utah at a time where the churches were being bombed. I was one of the suspects. People are keeping an eye on me. Like, I'm weird and smart. I'm weird and smart, and they're keeping an eye on me, and I'm in mental institutions. I have the serial killer triad, which, if you don't know, you can look it up. It means I like to play with fire, I do things to animals I shouldn't, and I wet the bed. Like, this is constant. I'm real fun at slumber parties, and I'm not high enough to ride the, tall enough to ride the roller coaster. There is nothing good happening in my world. And then one day, I'm roughly 16 years old. I think I'm 16 years old. I can't promise you I was 16. But Ray Wells, he and I had a birthday. My birthday's in April. We have a birthday together. We got our driver's licenses together. He asked me, do you want to go to a concert? And I say, yes, I do. I want to go to a concert. Why not? He takes me to a concert, and he drives up and parks his Jeep in the parking lot, reaches back in the back, grabs a paper bag, and there's four California coolers. Two quarts for him, two quarts for me. And he says, Brent, would you like one? And I go, yes, I do. This is not peer pressure. There was no thought of the prejudices and warnings of my peoples. No, nothing. Unscrewed it, and down it went. And you know what happened to me happens for a lot of you. You know what happened to me in about 15 minutes, because that's what it takes for the alcohol to come down and circulate in the bloodstream and actually affect me. In about 15 minutes, I don't know this is what's happening, but all those voices in my head, and I got a lot of them, they go quiet, and I come into life. I've been having relationship with every idea in my head. I've been having imaginary arguments. I've been having discussions in my mind. Like, all that stuff is constant, constant, constant. There is no room when I'm listening to the chatter to actually engage life. I didn't know that was ever going on, but as soon as the alcohol hit my brain, boom. That's magic. At this point, I have like 10 years of great psychotherapy, great meds. This cured me. And I had a great night. I went to a punk rock concert that night. I am, though, dressed like a cute Mormon boy. I have penny loafers on. There's pennies in the shoes. Still, I have khakis on. I got white button-up shirt, button all the way to the top, a little black bow tie, and a sweater vest, and a cute little haircut. And I do not ride the roller coaster still. I had the time of my life hanging out with people I don't hang out, in places I don't belong, and doing things I've never done before. And I'm in life at last. The mosh pit was like, you were elbowing my face, I'm getting you in the groin. Like, this is payback. Wow, let's do this again. I went to the bishop on Sunday. I go, Bish. I'm already getting cooler. Like, Bish. We need to drink more. I mean, this is a reasonable thing to come out of my mouth. This is completely understandable. You don't know. If you knew what it was like for me to be sober and in life, you would not question why I drink. Wow. The bishop naturally goes, Brent, we're not going to be changing the word of wisdom for you. And there's a natural progression to what happens next. I'm going to go find new friends, new playmates, new playthings, because I am going to do this again. It was an outright spiritual experience as described in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. It fully changed my perspective. As far as I'm concerned, man, it probably saved my life because I have those suicidal ideations and actions. It probably saved my life, the discovery of alcohol. I know it cured my bedwetting. Because as soon as I started to drink, I didn't wet the bed anymore. Might be different for all of you, but this is what happened to me. And all I can tell you is I am going to go pursue that effect over and over and over again. I know that Dr. Silkworth says we drink essentially because we like the effect produced by alcohol, man, that comes from a non-alcoholic. Great doctor, great practitioner, but that's the most understated line in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, in my opinion. We love the effect produced by alcohol. I don't know that I have promised King Alcohol my career, my children, my wives. Right? I don't know that I've promised King Alcohol everything worthwhile in life. But I did. Because what happens to me when I get sober? The voices come back. I hate you. I hate me. You won't cooperate. You won't behave. The judgment machine ramps up. Right? Dr. Silkworth describes this beautifully. When sober, we're restless, irritable, and discontent. How can you hang in life if that's your perpetual state of being? If that's your state of being, you need relief. If we're perpetually restless, irritable, and discontent, I am going to drink again. There's no question in my mind. Because it's horrible, awful, and dark to be sober and running the show. I pursued it. I'm smart. I go off to college. I think, because every time you get sober, I'm getting miserable. Every time I get sober, I'm going to an institution. I think maybe my family, maybe all of the people around me, maybe my counselors, maybe my peers are telling me the truth. If you get a career, maybe then happiness will be found. So I go to college and I go, at college, we just make chemicals. I'm smart. We make lots of them. I spent 4 years drunk. We had a still. We had vials in the medicine cabinet, in the cooking, vials of spices, right? That were distillations of everything you could buy on the street. Like, we had it all. And we'd use the still and those to have better living through chemistry. And I spent every day gone. I graduated. I attended class. I did those things that lots of people don't do. I'm still weird. It's like, hey, I'm going to class. My friends are going to class, and I graduate, and I then go and I work. I start to get a career. I start to pursue it. I think at that point that this career is not going to be it. It's not going to produce happy, joyous, and free. It's not going to produce a whole human. Right? So I save up my money, and at that point, I'm just going to say, let's go travel the world. So I worked my way around the world, and I thought I was being adventuresome and living. I will tell you what I was doing. Hey, man, end of the 80s, early 90s. There's raves all over Europe. I'm going from one city to the next, chasing the party. I can't even see that that's what I'm doing because I get a job in every one of these cities. I get a job working my way around the world. I work. I party. I work, I party. I work, and I go all over the world thinking I'm living life. Until you wake up one day with the realization it's worse, not better, still sober. I feel worse. Internally, I can't stand me that much more. I can't be with me sober at all at this point. I'm now certain that what I really need is a better career, a good career, a real paying career. So I go become a lawyer. And I choose my law school. I think I choose my law school, but I went to New Orleans for law school. And I look back on it and I go, of course I did. Are you kidding me? I went to the Big Easy. I had beer bottles in my backpack during school. Like, this is on again. I think I'm choosing and I'm being driven and I can't even see it. And in law school, I excel, because again, I'm smart. I used to take credit for being smart as just a gift from God. I used to think it was me. And I graduate near the top of my class from law school. I go on and I get a nice federal internship. I go get a fantastic career, and we do it in Seattle. I go to Seattle, Washington. And in Seattle, Washington, I get hired by the firm that I consider has God as a lawyer. Like the firm. The top. And don't you know it? I'm his right-hand guy. And I'm miserable again. Even more miserable than I was before. And I can't lie to myself about that. I'm now needing more alcohol, more vodka, more regularly, as in all the time. Whenever my head starts to chirp about me and about you, I need to get relief from that instantaneously, or the loony bin is calling my name yet again. And I can't stay that way. But I know what will solve it. It's not just a job. You need to get married. This is my head. This is my idea. Then the next one is like, I'm going to get married. I marry a lawyer. Right? Congratulations. Hey, for those of you who are like, if you haven't noticed this, the first wife of an alcoholic is usually a practice wife. Just saying, it's a man. This one was healthy, and at about five years of being together, she's like, Brent, you can't drink anymore. And what happens when somebody tells us we can't drink anymore and we're not ready to stay stopped? She's got to go. There is no question. There's no debate. You may feign some sadness. Oh, baby, I know. I'm so sorry. You may pretend. You may try to lie to them to ease it. But no, she's got to go. There is no question. She has to go. And so she does, right? We get a divorce. I say, the first wife, she was just the wrong one, right? Let's do it again. So this time I marry the coke whore. I don't even need to explain that, do I? Like, this is what we do. And of course, the thing to do next is have a child. This is linear thinking. Remember, I have my brother. He doesn't have this. You know what happens to my brother when he drinks? It plucks him out of life. It plucks him right out of life. And we can't understand that. It puts me in life and it plucks him out. No wonder he doesn't drink. No wonder he's not interested. He's already in life naturally. He matured. He grew up. He allowed God and life experience to then mold him and move him forward in life to a place where he's comfortable actually having no power. Right? You do not have power. The best we can be is in power. There is one that has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. God's address, right here, right now. May you find him now. There is no little sliver cut off that you can squirrel away and hoard and plug in as a battery, separate and apart from God. One that has all power. All we can do is tap into it and become animated and alive instead of part of the walking dead and breathing. Grace. In any event, we have a kid. First year of marriage to my second wife. I'll be kind to her. First, we have a kid. I'm delivering him. It's a natural birthing tub. 12 hours of labor. I'm sober. I'm not even thinking about it. I'm kind to her. I'm listening to the midwife. I'm following directions. I am present and in life. And at the end of it, I get to catch my son. And I get to see creation face in the breath of God. And I get to hold him. I have no thought of drinking or anything else. Wow. The voices are volume is down. I am really in life. That gave me relief for almost 3 days. Then the vodka started talking. 3 days. 3 days when I had the magical experience of delivering my baby boy. 3 days was all the relief I got. And then I had to go drink. And you know what? That idea that even the love of my son, the love for my son couldn't keep me sober, couldn't make life bearable, started to eat at me. And that starts to like really tear my insides up. At least the ideas of like, is life worth it? I thought that for sure, a baby and his love and my love for him. I grew up without a dad. This is going to do it. And I was dead wrong. 3 days was all I got. And the drinking started escalating. And you know what happens when two alcoholics bring a child in? The child is for sure the victim and the hostage. We just go through them no matter what. There was a time about 2 years of sobriety, not sobriety, 2 years into Denon's life where I saw the same terror in his eyes that I knew my brother and I grew up with. And my wife and I never intended that. Something had to be done. I need to do something about that. Something really's got to get done with this. I cannot keep drinking and living. This is not okay. Let's bring a second child. If one is good, two is better, right? And as beautiful as the birth of my first son was, I don't like this part. That night was hell. Giving same birthing tub, same midwife. I'm incapable of following directions. I am thinking about the vodka constantly. I can't be here. When is that woman going to give birth? Can you push it out? Isn't there something you can do? When is it going to happen? Hour after hour, and she's hitting me, and I'm hitting her back, and the midwife is telling me, maybe you shouldn't be here, Dad. Eventually, Tesher starts to be born. I catch him. And there was no relief. And I hate him. With every fiber of my being in that moment. And I split. And the bottle in the freezer was downed with a sense of desperation that I can't even describe. I drank with a sense of desperation after that for another almost five years. I couldn't hold a job anymore. The houses get foreclosed on. My wife and I, we end up moving in with the same people that Bill and Lois moved in with. We move in with our in-laws, right? Grandma's raising our children. I'm hating every morning. The best I deserve is to get up, go crawl into the shower, curl up in a fetal position, turn it on scalding hot. Because if I'm going to feel anything, I don't deserve to feel anything good. And then take the bottle. In oblivion. Eventually, at end-stage alcoholism, oblivion has to be the target point. There is no other point to reach. This is the part. We're seeking to die and not dying. We're seeking to not be in life, and we're still here. And this is alcoholic torture, right? You know, we're just going to keep living. We're the cockroaches. We're going to keep living like that and torturing ourselves. Some people die, but most of us keep on just living that hell. One day after another, after another, after another. And that's what was going on in my house. Not even my house, the in-laws' house. And they Oh my God. Every Christmas I send our kids and me back to Missouri. Misery. Shell Knob, tiny little town, podunk little Missouri. There are more stills in that town than people. Like this, and nobody has teeth. The meth capital. Like this, there isn't a stoplight. But those two good people raised my boys. And my boys deserve, and they deserve to have a relationship with their grandparents. So I make sure every Christmas that they are there with their grandparents. One night, it's February. It's near the anniversary of my father's death. And I do something I haven't done. F it, I give, Dad help me. I mean, I actually said it, but you know. Turns out that's a real prayer. It matches the directions on bottom of page 63 entirely. It's voiced. No more prayers in your head, people. Voice them. It tells you to voice them, sincere and honest, without reservation. All of that. That came out of my mouth, and in that moment, I hadn't done that in decades. And then, boom, I need to call Mommy. I hadn't thought about calling my mother in years. I call Mom. Mom, can I come live with you? I want to be sober. She says the same thing mothers say, if you're lucky. Yeah. I abandoned my family the next day, got a plane from Kansas City to Dana Point, Orange County. And my mother, being a good Al-Anon, had a man from Alcoholics Anonymous ready to take me to a meeting. And he took me to a meeting. He took me to a meeting every day for as many days as I can remember. Reentry into sobriety is hard for a guy like me. I'm crazy. I'm the guy that cannot sit still. For any of you newcomers who have sat through and actually listened to me, congratulations. I would have been the guy getting up, walking out, making a little noise, stomping my feet, and I took a blankie. Right? And nobody stuck their finger in my head. I mean, in my face and said, don't do any of that. They said, glad to see you. Happy you're here. I think. I have no idea if I ever identified as a newcomer. Maybe I did, maybe I didn't. I don't know. What I can tell you is that about day 33, day 35, I took a 3-year chip at a speaker meeting. My head told me I deserved it. I'm the idiot that listens. Remember that. My head said, you deserve a 3-year chip. I listened. I got up and gave a 3-year pitch, and you let me. And all you did was keep coming back. Later on, at 3 years, my sponsor had me go back to that meeting and do it for real. Right? Some of the guys that are in my home group still razz me about it, and it's all good. I get it. I have no idea why it was 3. Why not 10? Why not 1? It was 3. Yeah, crazy. Shortly after that, though, I'm starting to come into life. I'm starting to come into life, and some of the old-timers who have that glint and that sparkle in their eye, for real, I'm, like, intrigued. I have tried everything that I can think of, all my ideas, to live life happy and whole and comfortable in my own skin right here, right now, sober. Nothing's worked. And there's some men, these crusty old-timers, that have that. And I can't buy it. I can't read sufficiently. I can't educate myself. I can't get it. And I know that. And I ask one of them, hey, will you sponsor me? That's how I picked my sponsor. I even say I picked it. Probably not. It's more likely, from what I understand today, that the universe directed me. Right? And he did the thing that I've been taught to do, that I hope most of you do, is he read the book with me. When there was a question mark in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, he had us answer the question. And we read it line by line, cover to cover. Okay? When it said pray, we prayed. When it said write, we wrote. And I began to do and practice the principles that are outlined in this book called Alcoholics Anonymous and put them in life. Now, the great thing about my sponsor that you may or may not do is he let me argue with him. He let me call, no, no way, that's crap. That'll never work. Like, he let me be me in front of him, because at the end of the day, I still did and put into action, put into life the suggestion as written in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Attitude is evidently optional in a newcomer's life. Like, hey, I hate this. It's never going to work. At the end of a year, I will kill myself, but I'll do it. And that's what happened. Along the way, the universe was kind to me and gave me a little, like, hey, I call them God shots, attaboys, whatever. There was no way for me to not acknowledge that God's present and with me along the way. And mind you, I came in as a militant atheist. Like, belligerent, too. You talk God, I'll get in your face. And I'm pretty skilled with words. And I'll get in your face, and I have no problem taking a punch and bleeding on you. In fact, I wear that as a badge of honor. Like, okay, guess this is happening, right? But at the end of April, in my first year of sobriety, I already have a commitment. I got commitment at all my regular meetings at this point. I am starting to do this thing. This meeting, it's a speaker meeting, not unlike this one. And at this particular speaker meeting, there's a speaker, and I swear to God, I laughed as if it was the first time since I was a kid. Like, in life, sober, laughing and enjoying it. I was dumbfounded. I was like, oh my God, is this really happening, right? I understand that I heard the music of Alcoholics Anonymous. I heard another alcoholic, and I heard it for real. And I walked up to thank that guy, and I thanked him, and it turns out he was the lead singer of that same punk rock band when I got drunk for the first time. You mean I haven't been alone? Like, that's a special gift for me. Doesn't have to mean anything to you. But you got my attention, God. And with that, I started to really make sure I took the actions that are outlined in that big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I started to get, shortly after that, some other sponsees and start to walk them through and start to do the thing called Alcoholics Anonymous. In my home group, it's Blackfin only. It's a men's group. If you're ever down in Orange County on a Saturday morning at 8 a.m., we meet in San Juan Capistrano, and we read the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. We go on retreats together. We have a Christmas party together. We do barbecues together, and we read the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and we share in the understanding and the application of the principles in our lives to see what happens. And we do the same thing with the 12 and 12, and we repeat it, and we repeat it, and we repeat it, and there are 50 to 60 men all living, as one of our guys says, fabulous lives. It's unbelievable to me. Life got good. Thank you. Life started to get good. I didn't have my kids, though. I abandoned them. Right? As part of what had happened, my then ex-wife, okay, in sobriety, get divorced, ex-wife, she insists on having me drive the kids and her up to Portland, Oregon, to go move in with a man that she met online. I don't like this, God. What do? You show up for your children, you drive them up to Portland, Oregon, and you allow them constant access with you. And along the way, I kept doing things like that. And 6 years ago at Christmas time, back in misery, because of the rooms like this in the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and a gracious God, without lawyers, without my suggestion, without my asking, without my prodding, without anything, my ex-wife says, Brent, can our kids come live with you? Through the demonstration of the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous in real life and in real time, through the constant demonstration to a woman that I despised, the kids came to live with me. Now, unfortunately, there was a catch. Not a real catch. I didn't know it. 3 months afterwards, Tesher, the younger one, the one whose birth I hated, comes, Dad, can Mommy come live with us? It's not safe. Yes, son. I still live with my mother. She needs someone to take care of her. It's part of the role I play today. Right? She has dementia. She needs a lot of caretaking. I live with my two kids. And I live with my ex-wife. It makes dating really awkward. It's a beautiful life. I will leave you with one last story about my children and our lives. Right? It's not perfect, man. My mother and my ex-wife, boy, do they love to fight. They're both control freaks, and man, do they go at it. And every once in a while, I have to call Orange County Adult Services to make sure that there's not abuse happening in the home. I know there's not, but I do it anyway because that's what a responsible human being would do. My kid's now a sophomore in high school, and my older one's a sophomore in college. I took him away to college. He's going to college in Portland, Oregon. And he thanked me. Like, he didn't thank me for any of the things, like, Dad, you were such a great dad, a great role model. Thank you for helping me with homework. Thank you for putting food. None of that. None of these things that I thought were going to happen. He thanked me for allowing his mother to come and move in. He said, I now see that you and Mom should never be married. But more importantly, that it's not my fault. I didn't even know that was a thing. But of course it was a thing, because I blame me when God took my dad at the same age that I abandoned Denon, age of 6. I blame me. And I got to see a healing that occurred in real time that was magic. Oh my God. Had I even known it was a thing, I would have moved heaven and earth to make sure my son knew that it was not his fault. And all I had to do was to demonstrate the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous once again to the best of my ability in real time in front of my children. All of them. No secrets, no nothing. Kindness, love, and tolerance, and compassion. Perhaps compassion, especially for those who are still sick and suffering, like his mother. My life is amazing today. Right? It's not the life I dreamt of. There's no way I plan to live with my ex-wife, have a girlfriend on the side, and live with my mother. And this is not a concept that a growing boy ever has. But I get to have an experience in life one day at a time with you. Man, is it an adventure. It's a real adventure. I never know what's going to happen. And I love the surprises today. Like when it's horrible, somehow it's okay. And when it's filled with the magic, oh, I can never repay Alcoholics Anonymous for the magic that it has given me. And I recognize and appreciate every day that the same power that is moving the planets and keeping the earth in alignment and not floating off into space is in me. Right? And I know it's in you. And it's breathing us both. I love you all. Thanks for letting me share.